Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Why did you share?
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So Special Counsel Robert Hur before the House Judiciary Committee yesterday, providing some testimony, and really not much testimony, the transcript of his deposition with the big guy, Mr. 10%, President Biden, already out there. So it's really the opportunity, as most of these congressional hearings are, if you've ever watched one or heard us discuss one, they're sort of redundant in the sense that it's really the opportunity for speechifying from the members of the particular congressional committee that are doing the interrogation. Point here is to advance their characterization of whatever the topic is, the position that they're taking on the Republican side, the position that they're taking on the new Marxist side. And so that's sort of what happened yesterday. Doesn't mean that there weren't particularly useful moments of political theater. For example, when the band manager for the Socialist Spice Girls, Pramila Jayapal, the putty-faced representative from the state of Washington, when she tried to advance the Democrats' position that this her report had some pejoratives about President Biden that were unfortunate, but it was a document that exonerated him. That was the opportunity where Robert Hur pushed back to make it clear that at least he was not going to go along with that characterization.
All charges are warranted in this matter.
Correct.
So this lengthy, expensive, and independent investigation resulted in a complete exoneration of President Joe Biden. For every document you discussed in your report, you found insufficient evidence that the president violated any laws about possession or retention of classified materials. The primary law that you analyzed for potential prosecution was part of the Espionage Act, 18 U.S.C. 793E, which criminalizes willful retention or disclosure of national defense information. Is that correct?
Congresswoman, that is one statute that we analyzed. I need to go back and make sure that I take note of the word that you used, exoneration. That
Mr.
is not a word.
Mr.
Hur,
I'm going to continue with my questions. I'm going to continue with my questions. I know
that
the term
I ultimately reached I know that whether the term, sufficient evidence existed such that the likely
you
outcome
you exonerated
a conviction.
I know that
I did
the term willful
that
retention
not in the report,
has a Mr. Hur, it's my time.
Ooh. No, he didn't. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
The just sort of getting on the record for those who don't read but will watch news clips, which is, you know, your cable TV news watching audience, I suppose. That's why they make the big bucks. They did want to document just how slovenly was Joe Biden's record keeping when it came to these classified documents in his possession, and that he knew he had the classified documents in possession. So there's two useful moments, just sort of establishing the baseline to talk about whether or not he should be charged, and then to fold in Trump to talk about equal justice under the law, all of which happened yesterday. But here's a couple of GOP legislators just using some of their time to establish some facts. Per the report.
Mr. Hur, classified documents were found at the Penn Biden Center?
That's correct.
They were found in President Biden's garage?
In Wilmington, Delaware, yes.
And in his basement den?
Also in the same home, yes.
And his main floor office?
Correct.
And his third floor den?
Correct.
At the University of Delaware?
Correct.
And at the Biden Institute?
Correct.
Is it accurate to quote your report that classified documents were found in
quote, badly damaged boxes in his garage near a collapsed dog crate, a dog bed, a Zappos box, and an empty bucket. Is that correct?
Those words do appear in the report.
Basically what you're saying is that anywhere that Joe Biden went, classified documents were left behind.
Right.
Is that a fair statement?
Six different locations in three different states, and he was so careless with them that they're next to a dog bed and a collapsed dog cage. He parked by those documents when he drove his car. He must have known he was there. And what I learned yesterday is that he did this for money and for ego, because he was going to write a book. So that's why he
that's
some
the motive
documents, and then his ego.
That's the motive that Jim Jordan got to during his time. Right. You have to remember, and there's a lot of things to remember here. So I guess there's some utility to these hearings. The full context is he has a ghostwriter who's writing his memoir, and he's got an $8 million advance for it. So there's a lot of money on the table, and you know how that hillbilly crime family from Wilmington likes money.
Joe Biden had 8 million reasons to break the rules. Took classified information and shared it with the guy who was writing the book. That's why he did. He knew the rules, but he broke them for $8 million in a book advance. It wasn't just $8 million. It was also his ego. Pride and money is why he knowingly violated the rules. The oldest motives in the book, pride and money.
But it doesn't mean that House Republicans are satisfied with Robert Hur. They had some pushback for him, too. Tom McClintock on not charging Biden or recommending Biden be prosecuted. And Matt Gaetz on this matter of the ghostwriter. I thought Gaetz made a good point here. You can't argue that the ghostwriter is too old and feeble and sympathetic to prosecute. So, how do you formulate your decision based on the evidence that you document in your report, which is that the ghostwriter destroyed evidence?
Ghostwriter has recordings of Biden making admissions of crimes. He then learns that you've been appointed. He then deletes the information that is the evidence, and you don't charge him.
That is reflected in the report. One of the things that Mr. Zwanitzer did not delete was transcripts of the recordings that he had created that included inculpatory evidence relating to Mr. Biden.
Oh, so if you destroy some evidence but not other evidence, that somehow absolves you of the evidence you destroy? Here's what I see. Zwaniger should have been charged, wasn't. Biden and Trump should have been treated equally. They weren't. And that is the double standard that I think a lot of Americans are concerned about.
Right. Why? I mean, Biden, Hillary, and Trump all had classified documents. And of those three, only Trump has been charged. Why, Dan?
Right. That back and forth there, though, too, about the ghostwriter. Mm-hmm. He destroyed evidence. You didn't charge him. Her says the evidence was inculpatory, in other words, implicating Biden in the crimes for which he was being investigated. So that's obstruction of justice. So why didn't you charge him? Well, because we've decided, he didn't say this, but because we decided that the big guy shouldn't be charged. So if the big guy isn't going to be charged, we're not going to charge the underling for the obstruction case, because then we said, well, if he obstructed an investigation to cover up a crime, then who was he obstructing it on behalf of? Well, now we get back to the big guy and having to explain why we're not charging him. So there was, you're left unsatisfied about Robert Hur's decision making. That's on the Republican side. And it's a little bit, the whole but Biden and Trump should be treated equally. I mean, that's sort of a normative political argument about the principle of equal justice before the law. But of course, some people get charged and other people don't, who've committed the same acts or similar acts routinely, because there's only so many resources and there's the judgment of prosecutors and so forth. I mean, this is sort of a special case because it's at the highest level and there's so much attention and there's so many parallels. But Remember, you're trying to advance your position that you're to dismiss the charges against Trump for his handling of classified documents, at least in your mind, because it's clearly they're going after Trump and applying a different standard to him than they are to Biden. And that exchange right there about the ghostwriter destroying evidence, I think, was one of the better ones in really suggesting that however critical her was of Biden and however embarrassing is that report for Biden and Democrats, however difficult it is for them to spin out of it. And as Jamie Raskin tried to do, which you'll hear in a second, there's still a fundamental problem where they pulled a punch on Biden that they didn't on Trump and Hillary, as you say. Mark on the South Side, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Dan, the one thing that's never been talked about is the security breach with this. When he was vice president and when he was senator, he was taking these documents. How did he get them out of there? To the best of my knowledge, aren't you supposed to view them? You're not allowed any electronic devices when you do view them. How did he get them out?
I'm sure his staff did. I mean, remember when he first got caught, so to speak, because, you know, he said, I've gone along with this investigation all along. But initially, he blamed his staff. Remember that, Dan?
I think that was about moving them around, right. Not necessarily obtaining them in the first place. But thanks for the call, Mark. I assume you can get hard copies and you view things in a skiff and then you can pull them out. Or during his time as vice president, he would have had more access to that. But there is a corollary to that question about security breach that was actually raised by Representative Laurel Lee, who's a Republican from Florida, about the damage assessment. So with his possession of all these classified documents on all these various topics, we don't really have the full rundown on that. And who had access to those documents, like Hunter and his Chinese communist friends, are there any consequences for America's national security, America's secrets, any consequences because of Biden's slipshod handling of classified information?
Since the release of the report, to your knowledge, has the Justice Department started to analyze a damage assessment of what may have been disclosed by these documents being mishandled and any ongoing national security risks from the inappropriate storage and retention of the documents?
Congresswoman, my understanding is that such a damage assessment is underway in coordination and cooperation with the members of the intelligence community.
Well, if it's in coordination with the members of the intelligence community, then you know we're never going to get that damage assessment, or except to the extent that nobody did anything wrong, just like at the Pentagon with General Austin, just like at Uvalde with the police department. Nobody ever does anything wrong. Institutions fail. Outcomes are catastrophic. Judgment calls are horrific. But nobody's ever responsible if you're in charge. Lewis, Southside, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy. This seemed like deja vu, because I remember General Petraeus. I don't know if you remember him in 2015.
Yeah.
In 2015, he was convicted of the same thing that Joe Biden was charged with, and that's showing confidential and top-secret information to his autobiographer. And for that, he was...
And lover. Yes.
Yeah, and for that he was given 2 years probation and fined $100,000. Okay, now what we missing is that what they don't want you to know is, and what they don't want you to do is, they don't want you to follow where those files were. He had files from Ukraine, China, and Afghanistan. They have what they call a SAR, suspicious activity reports. We need to follow that to see. Where was that money going to those all those LLCs he got out there?
Right. Thanks for the call. Right. Well, the special activities report is a big subject of the Comer investigation and now the impeachment investigation. House Oversight Committee now it's blown up into an impeachment investigation because of the House. So you're right about that. And the contents of the classified documents obviously aren't going to be disclosed because they're classified. We've seen some reporting on topic areas, but that doesn't tell us a lot, and we don't know who had access to them, but obviously there are suspicions considering of Biden Incorporated's relationships, financial relationships, and that money sloshing around into various Biden family bank accounts from America's enemies. So, good times.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Hey, business owners, is your business and money in good hands? Does your bank invest in your success? Hi, Mike Gallagher here, letting you know that when you need a relationship bank, Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. I love these guys. Not only do they have expansive industry experience, a strong financial track record, but they're also highly capitalized for strategic growth. That's so important. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. They know what it means to grow a business by designing solutions that are right for you and only you. These are real people. They're ready to help. So reach out to my friends at Signature Bank. Make the call today. 773-467-5630. 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Your business could be Signature Bank's next success story. Go online, signaturebank.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender, Signature Bank.
If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy talking about Special Counsel Robert Hur's testimony before the House Judiciary Committee yesterday over his 365-page report on Biden's handling of classified information, in which he does not exonerate him. He does not say that there was no improprieties. He just says, essentially, the conclusion was, that we recall, is that he is too feeble and congenial, I guess, sympathetic in that sense, to be convicted by a jury. And so I'm not going to trial if I don't think I can get a conviction.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line. Yet he could lead the country. That a jury wouldn't believe because he's had, you know, his memory is gone. But, oh, no, be the leader of the free world.
Yeah. Mm. His memory comes in and out a little bit, and that's reflected in the transcript. But the Democrats, again, that we were talking about before the break, the Democrat socialists, the new Marxists, they really focused in on criticizing her for these gratuitous comments, is the way that they would describe them. Pejorative is the term that Adam Schiff used, and her pushback.
But you chose a general pejorative reference to the president. You understood when you made that decision, didn't you, Mr. Hur, that you would ignite a political firestorm with that language, didn't you?
Congressman, politics played no part whatsoever in my investigative steps.
But you understood nevertheless, didn't you, Mr. Hur? Mr. Hur, you cannot tell me you're so naive as to think your words would not have created a political firestorm. You understood that, didn't you, when you wrote those words, when you decided to include those words, when you decided to go beyond specific references to documents? You understood how they would be manipulated by my colleagues here on the GOP side of the aisle and by President Trump. You understood that, did you not?
Congressman, what I understood is the regulations that govern my conduct as special counsel.
And those regulations
me to write a confidential report for the Attorney General,
which you knew would not be confidential.
Explaining my decision, and that is what I did, Congressman.
Mr.
I followed the rules.
You knew it would not be confidential.
I followed them. Yes, Congressman, what you are suggesting is that I shape, sanitize, omit portions of my reasoning and explanation to the Attorney General for political reasons.
No, I suggest that you not shape your report for political reasons, which is what you did.
That did not happen, Congressman. That did not happen.
Yeah, so can you imagine the indignity of Adam Schiff attempting to characterize you as a political hack, which is what you just heard him trying to do to Robert Hur? Adam Schiff, you're calling me a political hack?
Please.
You're suggesting that I shape the truth for political reasons? You are doing that, Mr. Russian collusion? Boy. You know, again, I understand hypocrisy is the tribute that vice pays to virtue, La Rochefoucauld. I got it. But boy, was that a moment for me, at least with the popcorn and the sody pop, watching Adam Schiff decry political hackery from Robert Herr.
My popcorn moment was just watching, Guam's going to tip over guy, Hank Johnson. And Eric Swalwell, the Chinese lover boy, just trying to link him so desperately to Trump.
I want to first see if you will pledge to not accept an appointment from Donald Trump if he is elected again as president.
There's nothing to do with anything.
Congressman, I'm not here to testify about what will happen.
Considering what I just laid out.
I'm here to talk about the report and the work that went into it.
But you don't want to be associated with that guy again, do you?
Congressman, I'm not here to offer any opinions about what may or may not happen in the future. I'm here to talk about the work that went into the report, which I stand by.
Yeah, honeypot Eric with the flatulence problem is... It's just, I mean, he is just so dumb.
Oh, I know.
I mean, again, maybe the only thing worse than being accused of political hackery by Adam Schiff is having the same accusation come in a more ham-handed way from Eric Swalwell. But that's what they have. I mean, right, so the special counsel in the Hunter Biden tax evasion case, the Delaware U.S. attorney, but he was appointed by Trump. Right. They don't understand how and hers from Maryland. You don't understand how U.S. attorney appointments work. And then you have to make specific assessments on the individual U.S. attorneys, your own judgments about their judgments and about whether or not they are political actors or law enforcement officers, because it's a mixed bag out there. And I got to tell you, so that whole line of questioning was a good indication of the desperation they have in trying to do damage control for the senile kleptocrat in the Oval Office presently. There's no question that was a real tell moment. But I got to say that I can see the conclusion that Robert Herr drew.
Okay.
I think it's difficult for him to make that call. Make the call that he did make. I mean, it's a difficult call either way, but it's a difficult call for him to make the call that he made because you can't ignore the legal context of the charges against Trump. And if you believe that there is evidence of wrongdoing such that the reasonable person would conclude that the target of the investigation broke the law, then I think you have to charge or recommend charging. And Herr didn't do that because he's, sort of doing jury handicapping. So if they hadn't done the SEAL Team 6 raid on Mar-a-Lago and charged Trump, or if they had previously charged Hillary Clinton like they did Petraeus, as we were just talking about a little bit before the break, the double standards here, then maybe I could see Herr taking a pass because there's at least some precedent in the recent past of equal application of the law. But since there isn't, I think it's a problem. That said, I don't think Robert Herr is a political hack. Oh. He doesn't strike me that way. I don't think obviously he's not
a toady. He was the adult in the room.
Well, obviously he's not a toady for Trump. That's obvious. But he's also not a toady for the left. He's not, like I think. Or he playing politics here the way that the special counsel in the Hunter Biden tax evasion case clearly was, to protect his political relationships back in Delaware or in D.C. or some combination of the two. That guy and the deals that he tried to cut say he's a political animal. Herr and the report that he did and the answers he gave and sort of the pushback. It didn't strike me that way. I think he, as I said before the break, I think he has a problem that Gates properly raised with not charging the ghostwriter for destroying evidence. But the ultimate decision he makes is why that becomes complicated, because I think on balance, if you take in the context, which you have to do, you have to be pragmatic as a prosecutor too. He's being pragmatic in one direction, but I think he misses the larger pragmatic play and the evidence to support it, which would have been to charge. But that's not the same thing as saying that he's just a political animal. Right. And he took his share of heat from Republicans, as he well should have, not just Gates, but also McClintock, too, essentially making the same point about this, you know, confusion to the layman of one set of laws for this guy and another set of laws for the other guy.
And certainly it would be exculpatory if I simply told you, hey, I'm getting old. I don't remember stuff the way I used to.
Congressman, I'm not here to get into hypotheticals. I'm here to talk about the facts and the work that I did.
It was not a hypothetical. This is the issue at hand. You correctly noted in your report that former presidents and other senior officials have been given wide latitude in their possession of classified information, and I believe your decision not to prosecute Biden for the same offense is consistent with that precedent. But the problem is that precedent changed with the administration's decision to prosecute Donald Trump. And the irony is that as president, Trump had full discretion over handling classified material and full discretion in deciding which records to retain. As a senator or vice president, Joe Biden didn't have that. So now we get to this glaring double standard. I think it would be toxic to the rule of law on its face if it was just two ordinary citizens. But the fact that the only person being prosecuted for this offense happens to be the president's political opponent makes this an unprecedented assault on our democracy. This is the worst we could expect from a banana republic. And I wonder how you square this.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I want to get off my chest is after the, you know, he testified for 2 days behind closed doors, Biden did, and the mainstream media is like, her had the audacity to ask him when Beau died, his son. Well, Biden's the one who brought that up.
Yeah.
Not him.
Mm-hmm.
And people need to know also, too, that he said, I don't recall, I don't remember, and I have no blank, blank idea more than 100 times. He couldn't remember when Trump was elected. He couldn't remember when he was vice president, the years.
So, well, the whole who brought Beau's past date up,
yeah,
is important, not just because it was mischaracterized by the press, but because Joe Biden used that at that disastrous press conference to get all indignant and say, I told him, how dare you bring up my son's death? So like Robert Hur was the was the bottom feeder, was the impertinent one, when the transcript clearly shows he volunteered it, was fumbling around with trying to remember when it was, as he went off many times on tangents that were not particularly relevant. So it's also Biden's mendacity, which of course is a feature. It's been a feature his entire life. He is a profligate, plagiarizer, a cheat, and liar. Yes.
And he brought it up in context of he wrote a book and published it in 2017. And he said, well, what month did Beau die? And that's Biden was asking himself that question during this hour long sit down on October 8th. So that just never believe the mainstream media. Or even the president himself.
Len in Highland Park here in Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, guys. So if you watched Jesse Waters last night, he actually read the original transcript of the interview with her. And
I don't watch Jesse Waters. Because
I don't care what you watch. I know is he read the transcript. Okay. Biden is a blithering idiot. And her was generous in his initial description of him being a doddering old man who can't remember anything. If you read this transcript, I can't believe this guy's president of the United States. I mean, I couldn't believe it when they hit him in the basement. But, I mean, he is worse than I thought he was. He's making car sounds about his Corvette. It turns out that he wasn't allowed to, and I used to kid about him not being able to take his Corvette out of the driveway. It's true. He used to have to drive the Corvette back and forth in the driveway. It's just amazing. And her was one of the best people, him and Jonathan Thurley, I think, are just amazing at how they conduct themselves, how they choose their words with incredible thought and wisely. And, I think he was generous in his description, and I'll let you elaborate from that.
Yeah, thanks for the call. Yeah, there's all sorts of Commander McBragg moments because that's who Joe Biden is, the fabulist, makes things up, and goes on, you know, weird, uncomfortable tangents. You left everything in place, Biden told her in reference to special counsel search of his lake house. I just hope you didn't find any risque pictures of my wife in a bathing suit, which you probably did. She's beautiful.
I know.
Yeah, now Dr. Jill's a real hot number there,
hey, that's
Joe.
Why their
thanks.
Sex life is so hot.
Yeah, well, of course. Best sex he's ever had right now. Best sex they've ever had is happening right now. I want you to think about that this morning.
Yes. Yeah.
Uh-huh. He told a story about his visit to Mongolia in August of 2011, where he hit a target, where he had a little archery excursion during the visit,
yeah.
And he hit a target hundreds of yards away. He said, "I'm not a bad archer," I'm quoting Biden from the transcript, "I'm not a bad either, a bad archer," Biden said, after referring to Mongolian archers as gorillas, "but I hit the god target." A video uploaded by the Obama administration on the occasion of the occasion shows Biden shooting a bow and arrow into an empty field. This is very much like you're traipsing through the Himalayas with President Xi and his forays with Corn Pop. And we had a really difficult professor. He talked Biden, unrelated story, unrelated to any question that her asked. I didn't take law school very seriously. But we had a really difficult professor. He called on me to, you know how they do it in law school, discuss a case, you know, in your first torts class. Yeah. The Socratic method, is that what you're searching for, Mr. Brown? Going back to Biden. And I never read the case, and I stood up, and I spoke for 10 minutes. The whole class stood up and started clapping. That happens in law school. Biden, you'll remember, falsely claimed he graduated at the top of his class from Syracuse, failed a class after plagiarizing from a law review article about torts.
Oh, there you go.
I mean, it is endless with this guy. How many times do we have to say it? He was a buffoon at 29 when he was elected to the Senate, and he's been a buffoon ever since. He's a goof. He is not bright. He is not much of a wordsmith. He is a profligate fabulist. That hasn't changed.
He's delusional.
He's just gotten,
worse with old age, I think.
Well, he's got worse with old age. And because he's told so many ridiculous invented stories, now that his capacity is failing, he can't remember them all.
Well, he can't remember.
And he's inventing new ones, right. Apparently.
The truth is and what fantasy is.
Carl in Barrington, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning. Mr. Hurt reasoned that he would not be able to get a conviction because the defense would be that the president was just a feeble, well-meaning old man. Now, I know that defense attorneys confer with their clients before they present a defense, and I think Mr. Hurt's reasoning is faulty because I can't see the Biden family ever allowing defense attorneys to present the president as being a feeble, faulty old man. I think they would just say, you better come up with something else. There's no way we're going to allow that. And I think, again, Mr. Hurd's reasoning was faulty in that that's what the defense would be.
Thanks for the call, Carl. That's a good point. Yeah, that's a good point, especially if there was a prospect of a trial before the election. John in Crown Point.
Hey, how you doing, guys? Love you. Hey, you see that American Picker show, American Picker Celebrity Style, where they went to Joe Biden's garage, Mike and Frank?
that would be a good
they
episode.
They ripped off Joe Biden. They got a big box of documents for like $1.50.
Yeah. That was a great get. Thanks for the call, John.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one, Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Loyola Academy in leafy Wilmette, the cobblestone streets of Wilmette. Loyola Academy.
Oh, you paint a nice picture. Pristine place, yes.
Mm-hmm. It's ostensibly a Catholic school. Ostensibly. Jesuit, you know. Someone over in that community sent me something that's being used as an instructional tool at Loyola Academy, that conservative, that Catholic school. Hardly conservative.
Yeah, please watch yourself, Dan.
It's the Wheel of Power and Privilege. Have you seen the wheel?
Oh, no.
Do you know where you are on the wheel? Would you like to spin the wheel and buy a vowel? Buy some privilege? The Wheel of Power and Privilege. Power is at the center.
Okay.
And then around the wheel, the outer rung. This is like Dante's Inferno here, the rings of hell. On the outer rung, the categories by which you measure power. Citizenship, skin color, formal education, ability, significant, abilities, ability, disability, sexuality, neurodiversity, mental health, body size, housing, wealth, language, and gender. You got all that?
Body
Anybody want to audit this class? So, for example, and then, the marginalized line. The marginalized are, for example, the marginalized rung as you go through these, from the outside to the inside through the concentric circles that lead you to the center of power.
Okay.
Marginalized would be if you're undocumented, if you're dark, if you're vulnerable in terms of your mental health. What is that exactly?
Yeah, what does that
mean? And then when you get to the power rung, as you're closing in on power,
yeah.
You know who has power and privilege?
White people.
White
men.
Citizens. Cisgender men.
Cisgender.
Let's be specific.
Okay,
please.
Excuse me.
The rich. The property owner. The slim person.
Excuse me, Dan.
The
thin shame now.
Some of this is hard to read in so many levels. Well, the heterosexual, of course.
Are you going to tweet this Wheel of Power out?
Yeah, I will.
Because I want to see this Wheel of Power.
Yeah. So this is happening at your one of your leading Catholic high schools in Chicagoland. I mean, we've documented Loyola and other high schools, including my own alma mater, Bennett Academy, and their descent into social justice madness, which has happened. You've had big donors pull out of Loyola, at least make public pronouncements that they're no longer donating to Loyola Academy for reasons along these lines. They're racial identity politics, their general identity politics, their neo-Marxism is what it really is. And I just, figure maybe this, since this Wheel of Power and Privilege bubbled up here, we do a stop, look, and listen about where things stand, because we've done so many stories over many years now like this, and there's been these, blips where there's been some pushback. I remember a Loyola Academy, too. They had some, diversity, some die bureaucrat who made some typically ignorant comments that you would get from a die bureaucrat. And there was some pushback on that, too. But I just, first of all, to know that it persists, you think you had this moment, or you think you had some big wheel, per the Wheel of Power and Privilege, say, we're stopping donations, and the school is properly chastened, and we're not going to do that anymore. No. They gird their loins for the controversy du jour and promise to be better and more inclusive and patronize people with criticism. And then they carry on doing what they've been doing because they have an ideology they're committed to, not a constituency. You see the difference?
312-642-5600. Turnkey.proanswerline. You could reach us on our text line, 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment. Somebody already texted in. Dan and Amy, what is neurodiversity?
One teacher, by the way, just so we name names, one teacher, Patrick Brown, is trying to conflate oppression and power with the Beatitudes. So now you're sort of leveraging religious affiliation to advance a political ideology, you know, through guilt. Well, they understand. They understand how to advance the flag. If only the more sensible did, the people that are you know, truly committed to the faith or even just to the school. If you think this is a proper way to educate kids, you know, it's funny. I had this conversation. I had a conversation where I had a cup of coffee with Father John Belmonte. He used to be the head of the schools in the Joliet Diocese, where Bishop Hicks and his successor have made a complete mess. And the schools are closing. There are schools closing and the enrollment is declining, as it is everywhere. Even with a little bump during COVID. What an opportunity, what a missed opportunity. Why did the opportunity get missed, I wonder? I was talking to him because Father John Belmonte is now the head of schools for the Venice Diocese in Southwest Florida. And in Southwest Florida, at least under Father Belmonte's leadership, you're seeing an explosion in Catholic enrollment. I think if I'm remembering correctly, it's up 40% in the last 4 years. Huh. Well, what's going on in Southwest Florida that's not going on in Joliet? That's not going on at Loyola Academy or Bennett Academy? I wonder. Well, one of the things is that this using the classroom to play identity politics and spin the wheel of power and privilege, that's out. The other thing is Florida has school choice for all. And Father Belmonte understood something that the school choice movement in Illinois clearly didn't ever. They still don't understand it, even after the program got tubed. You have to promote it so people know about it. You have to access. You have to actively get the word out so there is access. Now, of course, even with the time that it existed, 5 years, and even with the relatively poor marketing, you still had, you know, more scholarship applicants than money available. But it's also marketing to the donor class, too. The prospect of this being taken away if we don't get to these thresholds, understand the political landscape of Illinois, and demanding, rather than genuflecting before on these issues, the clergy, the Supiches, and the Bishop Hickses of the world getting out and demanding that they participate in something you think they would obviously want to, but they clearly didn't, is the growth, if not salvaging, of their schools. Just amazing. And Belmonte's in a pretty unique position since he's been the head of the schools in the Joliet Diocese, and now he's the head, as I said, down in Southwest Florida in Venice. Kind of, but it's an interesting comparison contrast to be had, isn't there now? And what's happening in the two regions and why it's happening. So is this going to spark anything in Loyola Academy, or is everybody sort of after a couple of rounds on topics such as this, you know what? Don't want to get involved. Just got to get my guy through Loyola. and on to college, and then, you know, it's not my problem anymore.
I've heard parents say that.
Of course. Parents. Find the few parents.
My youngest is there. We only have a few, you know, one more.
Find the few
left.
Parents who don't say it.
Yeah.
That's the prevailing attitude, not the exceptional one. Well, that's fine, but then don't expect that your school is going to, the school that you thought you were sending your son or daughter to, is going to be that school anymore. It's not that school now, for those who are, you know, legacies or even just, you know, recall what Catholic schools in Chicago and Chicagoland used to be like. And the other thing, too, is it's doubly distressing because one of the features of Chicagoland was the Catholic schools, Catholic school systems. I mean, there's not a lot of places that have the concentration of those schools, which provided some school choice, even in a state dominated pre and post scholarship by the teachers unions, provided some school choice and some good education, some good educational options. Not a lot of places have that infrastructure. Maybe people in Chicagoland don't appreciate that. Florida certainly doesn't, but it's starting to. But, you know, nobody's going to kick up much dust. Right? Nobody wants to have this uncomfortable conversation about what's happened to these schools. Just keep our heads down, plod along. Don't make no waves. Don't back no losers like a ward healer in the city. And my kid's fine. Well, I have some news for you. This has been going on at Loyola Academy for a while at the hands of people like this Patrick Brown character. So your kid isn't fine. And by the way, speaking of talking to parents, and we sent their kid to Loyola and they came back like this. Or over time, we could see the change into something else. Right. Yeah, you don't say. And then we sent them off to college and they came back like that. And then they went to med school and they came back even worse. And then they went to corporate healthcare, if you want to continue the med school example, and they came back even worse still. Right, because it's the same program from grade school to high school to college to post-grad to corporate. Same program, literally. And it's just pounded and pounded and pounded and pounded. In the government systems, for the most part, in the private school systems, for the most part, including Catholic schools. But I'm going to pick my spot somewhere else. I'll tell you what, the other side is going to make it pretty difficult for you to call the spot you're going to pick. There aren't going to be any spots left after not too long. We're not winning. I mean, this isn't to be demoralizing. It's just to give an assessment of the landscape. You think because, again, you take out a couple of university presidents or you have University of Florida get rid of their die bureaucracy that we've reached peak cancel culture. We've reached peak race hustle and identitarian era. And now it's going to naturally be on the wane. That is not true. Not even close to true. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Morning Answer.
On AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. We were talking about these self-flagellation spas to release guilt toxins that masquerade as schools, particularly in wealthy honky enclaves like Loyola Academy and Wilmette. By the way, I posted the Wheel of Power and Privilege on Twitter, so you can feel free to share, pick out your own, spin the wheel, and, you know, pick your own victim status? Because that's what this is about. Right? When you say privilege is being white, male, Christian, well, we don't want to be those things. That's privilege. Ooh, that has a negative connotation. Something is like you have something that was unearned. Well, I don't want to be part of that. I want to be the part of getting. I want to be, you know, in the group where you get something because you have been wronged, even though I have no idea how I was wronged. I was wronged because they said I was wronged. Now I get something for it. Now I have been righted and I also get something for her. Get some recompense. I'm the hero of the story. I overcame something and survived and was rewarded and celebrated. Which category do kids want to be in? Kids looking for acceptance. That category or the you have privilege. Tisk, tisk. Here are the labors of Hercules you must perform. Well, those sanctimonious self-flagellation spas. Make everybody feel better about themselves? Well, you better plug up your ears, avert your eyes. You got to do that a lot to feel good about pushing identitarian politics. Children who have gender dysphoria will no longer be given puberty blockers, according to the government health system in merry old England. Government said that the evidence about either how safe they are to take or whether they are clinically effective to justify prescribing them to children and young people who are transitioning. Not enough evidence on either score. Nice, carefully, NHS, England, has carefully considered the evidence and a review conducted by the Orwellian acronymed NICE, government healthcare system there, and concluded not enough evidence to support the safety or clinical effectiveness of puberty-suppressing hormones to make the treatment routinely available at this time. So now places like Illinois are more radical than government-run healthcare systems in Western Europe. Well, what else is new? We're more radical than Western Europe when it comes to abortion on demand. Anything that involves separating children from parents and families from the church, well, that's where you'll find Illinois. Illinois policymakers. The Illinois electorate, clearly, who installed those policymakers. No more puberty blockers. Huh. Well, something else, too, again, please tell your identitarian friends to plug their ears and avert their eyes. I hate for them to have to remove any signage in their front yard. It's a California study. You know how I'd rather have a live boy than a dead girl and a girl than a dead boy when it comes to mutilating your kids, and that's the excuse that's used? Study finds that attempted suicide rate among trans women, that would be men, who received vaginoplasty in California, twice as high during the period after the surgery compared with the period before the surgery. Investigators analyzed all 868 people who received a vaginoplasty and 357 people who received a phalloplasty for over 6 years, 2012 to 2018. Twice as high the it's more than suicidal ideation, actually, than after the surgery as prior to the surgery. If there was a psych encounter prior to surgery, 34% of the vaginoplasty group, I just like saying vaginoplasty, and phalloplasty.
So gross, yes.
If there was a psych encounter during the prior to the surgery, 34% of the vaginoplasty group and 27% of the phalloplasty group had a psych encounter after the surgery. Among those receiving the vaginoplasty, the rate of suicide attempts was twice as high after the surgery at 3.3% compared with 1.5% before. Well, I mean, I'm just reporting the science and data because I know the men and women of the new Marxist movement are men and women of science and data. You can factor that in however you'd like. But again, don't let that dissuade anyone from mutilating their kids sacrificing them on the altar of identity politics, the new religion.
And once you do the vaginoplasty, you're not going back.
What about the phalloplasty?
Yeah, explain.
Are you an expert in that area as well?
I know the vaginoplasty. I'm familiar with that because I remember I had to follow that transgender guy who transitioned. He was a warrant II officer at Fort Bliss in El Paso, and he decided Terry became Terry. And, oh, my God, it was just barbaric, the fact that they even performed these surgeries. And then what she had to go through, and I'm sure that, you know, there's, you know, innovations now and that it's maybe less painful or easier, but that was a 9-month process. But back then you had to go through a year of solid year of counseling before any doctor would touch you.
It's gone
by the wayside.
Yeah, a little bit different these days.
Yeah,
Jane is a 14-year-old tomboy influenced online to believe she was trans. A sexual assault then motivated her to transition. Jane sang, and we've got the audio, but it's in French, so I'm just reading what she said. I said to myself, ah, if I had been a guy, it wouldn't have happened. In addition, I had disgust, in a sense, to be a woman because of this event. Just two consultations at McGill University's gender clinic resulted in her taking testosterone. Then she had a double mastectomy. Nearly immediately, she had regrets. Now she has detransitioned, but doctors say to have breast reconstruction, she must wait 2 to 3 years and have psychological follow-up for more than a year. Oh, on the back end. No psychologists were needed before doctors cut off her breasts. We're so enlightened in the West, aren't we? Let's see. I mean, this is like talking about repeat violent offenders, foreign and domestic. All we can do is tell the stories. Another 14-year-old. 14-year-old girl walked into a private clinic. This guy, Billboard Chris, is doing a lot of traveling the world and documenting these horror stories on Twitter. Worth checking out. 14-year-old girl walked into a private clinic in Quebec. She was trans, said she was trans, was given a testosterone prescription in less than 9 minutes.
9 minutes?
14 years old. We had the WPATH files that we talked about last week that Michael Schellenberger released over at environmentalprogress.com. It's documenting all this. We've got audio of these ghouls talking about drugging minors and getting them on the glide path to transitioning. It's a small group of the population, but it's an enormous political force, and it's an enormous destructive political force culturally, and even obviously more in a more pronounced fashion with the actual victims here, like these stories we're reading. So 9 minutes, she's a 14-year-old, has got her testosterone prescription. The doctor then started talking to her about surgeries and if she wanted to preserve her fertility in only about 5 minutes. That was her first appointment.
Oh my God.
14-year-old walks in. She's got a testosterone prescription, and they're talking about surgery in 15 minutes.
See, this is a money grab.
Of course it's a business.
It's a big industry.
It's a business, but it's also an ideology.
Yep.
Because you need the ideology to rationalize the business.
That's sickening.
Uh-huh. The first time the doctor has seen the patient, she quickly goes to the heart of the matter. You can tell me, the doctor says this, fortunately, a little deep down, since when did you know you were not in the right body? Is it childhood? Is it more in puberty? Sasha, the 14-year-old, describes how she vomited at age 12 and her mother took her to see a psychologist. That's when they said I had an eating disorder. I told myself that it couldn't be eating disorders. It didn't make sense in my head. But at 13, I came across a video of a trans person who talked about having eating disorders. But in fact, it was because she was in the wrong body. At that moment, I really recognized myself in that person. Right. These are the people you have medical professionals
influenced.
Saying these 13-year-olds were literally what he said were there to affirm the 13-year-old, the 13-year-old doing a self psych diagnosis. She vomited. Mom says I get an eating disorder. No, I don't. I see a YouTube video that somebody who transitioned said she had an eating disorder. That must be me too. Let's get it on. And the doctors say, damn right, let's do it.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
This is all documented. This story, there's video of it. 5 minutes into the consultation, the doctor addresses the question of surgeries. Are you considering surgeries in the future, he says? Surgeries, yeah. Doctor,
I want to get my driver's license first.
Surgeries, she says, yes. Doctor says, like, a gender mastectomy, removing the chest, yeah. There are other surgeries that exist, too. We have a uterus at the bottom with ovaries, so basically it's possible to remove. It's something that can cause dysphoria. The narrator, testosterone can make a woman infertile. Fertility is the subject of the question. The doc says to her, is fertility, I understand that it's perhaps far away for you at 14, but is fertility something you want to maintain before you start? Sasha at 14. No, I always knew I didn't want children.
Yeah.
The doctor says, basically, the logic now, I will prescribe hormones today because the logic is that basically there's nothing in your profile that would stop me from giving you hormones. Oh, I'll start with one dose. It's not a mini dose. It's like an intermediate dose between adults and non-binary, let's say. Sasha says, okay. Doctor says, no problem. The best is yet to come.
Best is yet to come.
Well, yeah, because you got all these surgeries to look forward to.
Nothing should be done to anybody until they're an adult. And even that is questionable. But, I mean, seriously, because, come on, you remember being a kid, you change your mind. Girls always say, oh, I don't want kids because they think it's a cool thing to say when deep down in their heart. They don't even know yet because they're 14. They don't even drive a car yet.
We're not supposed to question the judgment of, you know, 13 and 14-year-olds. We don't do that anymore.
They're kids.
Mike's outside.
Hey, good morning, y'all. These gender whatever affirming or crazy surgeon doctors, they're no different than the Kermit Gosnells of the past, because all they're doing is making these sacrifices on the altar of liberal leftism, and they're just doing it in smaller doses so we can ingest it less painfully than watching a bunch of babies get torn to shreds. They're just doing it to our grown babies. It's insane, and they got to be stopped.
Thanks for the call, Mike. Well, you know, if they got to him early, you know, trying to get people to understand this continuum here. Give you an example of what I'm talking about on the indoctrination side of it. First grade teacher in Minnesota. First grader. She teaches first graders. She's testifying on legislation that would ban bands of the LGBTQ flag in classrooms.
That has no business being in a classroom. You just have the American flag and keep it simple.
This would ban bands. So it's not banning the rainbow flag. It's banning any attempts to not have rainbow flags in the classroom. First grade teacher in Minnesota testifying on behalf of the prohibition on prohibitions of rainbow flags. First graders, she teaches.
I use she, her pronouns, and I've been a first grade teacher for 16 years. I'm here in support of this bill to make rainbow flag bans prohibited. What does a rainbow flag mean to my students, my classroom? Here are some words from my first grade babies. It means my teacher will stand up for me. It looks like the flags at my house, so I feel home. It means we all are here together. My students feel the importance of windows and mirrors. I want every child, family, and staff member to have a clear visual of inclusion and safety in the community I build. We know students, families, and staff members need to feel safe in order to learn, thrive, and continue to share their talents with us. My rainbow flag stands for welcoming spaces, trust, resilience, compassion, joy, collaboration, and community without judgment. And don't we all want that for all kids? I will always have agency to represent all communities in my classroom. It's important my students see their own and their family's identities in my space. Whether that includes our mural of Black excellence, our land acknowledgement written with some of our Native families, or my rainbow flag stating you are loved. My students, especially those whose stories are often left out, must feel represented and important, and it seems absurd that someone could take away that humanity from my students. So a piece of clarity from a former first grader, now 18, who still comes back to my safe space. Our rainbow flag means we'll always belong. Thank you for hearing my testimony.
That's for a classroom full of six-year-olds. Carol in Moments.
Well, you know, thinking about this, how many 11 and 12 year old girls do you know or know of? Maybe not you, Dan.
If you do,
not my wheelhouse.
Period.
No.
It's like, oh, goody gumdrops. Oh boy, it takes a long time to get used to this stuff. You don't make these decisions rashly.
Oh boy.
So thanks for listening to me.
All right, thanks for the call, Carol. Get a little uncomfortable, like
things got weird quickly.
Yeah, when I first was told about the birds and the bees, you know, last week. Christian Buttigieg, that's Mayor Peabots.
Husband.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Don't they have twins now or something? They have children.
Okay. Yeah, well, I remember seeing the picture of them in the delivery room.
Yeah.
When one of them
decided to hop in the bed as if they just gave birth.
I guess.
Creepy.
Maybe they're butt babies.
Oh,
I don't know.
Maybe they did have butt babies. Oh, look at the butt babies.
A Christian Peabot, Mr. Peabot, is, I guess he runs some sort of gay camp.
Camp for gay kids. Yes.
Mm-hmm. And he fancies himself a former educator of some sort.
And remember, he's a father when you hear this.
Well, also remember what you just heard from the first grade teacher in Minnesota. Mm-hmm. The rainbow flag in the first grade classroom, so it can be all pronoun and gender affirming, right next to the land acknowledgement document. So it's not just there to represent all those wonderful things that that teacher described. It's also there for you to pledge to in lieu of the American flag. Just ask Christian.
All right. I pledge my heart.
I pledge my heart.
To the rainbow.
To the rainbow.
The not so typical gay camp. And equal rights for all.
With affirmation and equal rights for all.
Watch your heads.
I'm sorry, I don't know. I may have had that audio confused. I'm not sure if that was Christian Buttigieg's gay camp or if it was Loyola Academy, the religion class. I'm not sure. Now I'm a little confused. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. For all the accusations that were leveled in the direction of Special Counsel Robert Hur yesterday before the House Judiciary Committee hearing, both veiled and not so veiled, of political hackery by the likes of Eric Swalwell and Adam Schiff, technically an officer of the court in Schiff's case. Amazing that he was a former prosecutor. Hopefully Steve Garvey does a deep dive on that record in the context of his, you know, I get Sisyphean Senate race, but nonetheless, it's worth it.
Just can't see him being a senator. It's not right.
And Cori Bush, just to give you a little flavor of it before we hear from Special Counsel Robert Hur discussing the details of his 350-page report, in which he recommended against charging Joe Biden for mishandling of classified information, because essentially, while there was inculpatory evidence against him, he didn't believe he could get a jury to convict him. And so this is why he recommended against. But just to give you a sense of what you're dealing with as Democrats run damage control for the contents of this report that put Biden, in his own words, in less than a favorable light when it comes to, I don't know, sapience for sure, sentience even, is in doubt. Cori Bush, she's the one with the multi-hundred-thousand-dollar security detail out of St. Louis. Newly minted member of the Socialist Spice Girls. We'll see how long she stays. This is how she used a portion of her time yesterday.
That the potential mishandling of classified information is a serious issue. And I believe it was appropriate for the Attorney General to appoint both special counsels in the Biden and Trump cases. As my colleagues have pointed out, President Biden fully complied with the investigation conducted by Special Counsel Herr, who did not find evidence sufficient to warrant criminal charges. Despite this outcome, Republicans have used the special counsel's report to further their longstanding efforts to re-elect the former white supremacist in chief, Donald Trump.
Shame. I mean, I
serious know. Person.
Yeah.
These are serious people.
She started talking. It was like, wah, 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 wah.
Adam Schiff in particular, since he's supposed to be the prosecutorial superstar in that group. Mm-hmm. You know, he did such a bang up job during the Russian collusion investigation where he was forever on CNN and MSNBC talking about a forthcoming smoking gun that was never produced. This is his exchange with Robert Herr over, you know, who is essentially playing politics here.
But you chose a general pejorative reference to the president. You understood when you made that decision, didn't you, Mr. Herr, that you would ignite a political firestorm with that language, didn't you?
Congressman, politics played no part whatsoever in my investigative steps.
But you understood nevertheless, didn't you, Mr. Herr? Mr. Herr, you cannot tell me you're so naive as to think your words would not have created a political firestorm. You understood that, didn't you, when you wrote those words, when you decided to include those words, when you decided to go beyond specific references to documents? You understood how they would be manipulated by my colleagues here on the GOP side of the aisle and by President Trump. You understood that, did you not?
Congressman, what I understood is the regulations that govern my conduct as special counsel.
And those regulations
me to write a confidential report for the Attorney General,
which you knew would not be confidential.
My decision, and that
which
is what I did, Congressman.
Mr.
I followed
you,
the rules.
You knew it would
knew
not
the rules,
be confidential.
And I followed them. Yes, Congressman, what you are suggesting is that I shape, sanitize, omit portions of my reasoning and explanation of the Attorney General for political reasons.
No, I suggest that you not shape your report for political reasons, which is what you did.
That did not happen, Congressman. That did not happen.
Right. And, of course, he had the exchange with Premier Jayapal, too, where he said, look, you keep saying exonerated, but this was not an exoneration of Joe Biden. So, you know, the question becomes, I mean, you know what the Democrats are doing. And by the way, so if I had said, to Adam Schiff, if I had said Joe Biden is a dizzying intellect and we were so impressed with what he had to offer, all the explanations were completely cogent and credible. They answered the concerns that we had, and we fully exonerate him. Would that have been political? Would that have been seized upon by one side? Of course, going in as a special counsel, no matter what you do, it's going to be seized on by politicians of both sides. So the idea that that this is, you knew it was going to be released. Well, Merrick Garland had indicated he was going to release at least some portion of it. So everybody knew. And, you know, obviously it was going to happen. But there's always going to be self-interested interpretations and assessments of a special counsel's report, just like there was for Mueller. But that wasn't political at all. And there was no concern about politics. And there was no concern about how it would be seized upon by this group or that group to advance their particular point of view. I mean, he's such a disingenuous hack, Adam Schiff. He's just not very good. I mean, I can at least appreciate somebody who is talented at practicing the dark arts of law and arguing things they know not to be true. But Schiff isn't even good at it. I mean, I guess he's good enough to convince California voters, but in any sort of absolute standard, it's pretty feeble, I thought. Anyway, for more on this, let's get a much more impressive legal mind than mine into the conversation, and that would lead us to Professor Richard Epstein, James Parker Hall, Distinguished Service Professor Emeritus of Law, Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Professor Epstein, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
It's very nice to be here and to listen to you, Ben. I like it.
Yes, thank you. I had to get that off my chest. Now I'll turn the turn the floor over to you. But I mean, with your assessment of Robert Herr's reasoning, and if you want to get into his testimony to support that reasoning, please do.
Yeah, look, the first thing I want to say is when you listen to Schiff and Cori Bush and everybody else, nobody asked the question of whether it was true or false. All they wanted to know was whether or not this thing has some political implications, and everybody knows that it does. He gave something to everybody in that sense, but I think the most important thing that came out is that Herr was an honest public servant being derided for doing what he was supposed to do. I mean, anybody who watches Joe Biden dotter across the stage and understand that he could barely talk even if he had the teleprompter in front of him and knows that he's about my age, but he's a hell of a lot more exhausted than I am. And never in my wildest dream would I want to assume a political position that requires you to work 24/7 with the entire fate of the nation resting upon your shoulders. And so what it is just an effort to bully this guy. And Schiff has always been a bully. Everything he's ever said has been wrong with respect to these various explanations. And remember, he was the man, as you pointed out, who made all of these really stirring claims about deep revelations of the corruption in the Trump administration, was never able to back any of them up. And in fact, what happened is, I always ask the following question, who's got the bigger mouth, Joe Biden or Donald Trump? Well, it's going to be Donald Trump by a mile. Who's made more illicit indictments? And who's been the victim of more of these things? Well, the Democrats have constantly gone on this warfare. And as best I can tell, Trump has never indicted anybody based upon the kind of political statements that come out of his mouth. And so it's really a very, very odd situation that you hear on the Democratic side and from the American Bar Association, which has become a completely useless organization, that we really are worried about threats to democracy. But they always assume it's the venting of Donald Trump, and they never assume that it's the rather insidious indictment and prosecutions of Joe Biden. And so there's a real disconnect there. If I could give Donald Trump one piece of advice, it would be shut up and people gratuitously. But, I mean, let's put it, those are not capital offenses. On the other hand, bringing false prosecutions against him, as they've done in case after case, against Trump is really, I think, a political scandal. And to sort of have the mantle of being only the defender of the rule of law and the sanctity of democracy is a kind of gross hypocrisy, which is done. I mean, Cori Bush is mindless in everything she says and she believes. Everybody's a white supremacist because the white supremacist is defined as somebody who disagrees with Herr. And I would certainly put me in that category, and I dare say put both you and Amy in that category.
Yes, absolutely.
So what happens is it's the debasing of language in political debate, which is most discerning on both sides. And it's once you put that in there, people who are not experts in policy find it very hard to get through the policy issues that are behind the debates to figure out who's right and wrong, so that the public discourse suffers by all of these kind of rambunctious outbursts on both sides of the political aisle. We are in a state of polarization worse than I've ever seen. I blame Trump for much of the silliness and the rhetoric, but in terms of the conduct, nobody beats the Democrats for playing the game of warfare, as we now, lawfare, L-A-W-F-A-R-E, which has become a popular term to explaining how it is that legal doctrines and legal prosecutions have been harnessed for political reasons.
I wanted to ask you, I kept hearing yesterday that, you know, President Biden, he cooperated with authorities, no warrant was needed, he let them search their house, but if you murder somebody and you lead police to the body, that doesn't mean that you didn't commit the murder.
Well, the correct way to say it is all that evidence would come in by way of mitigation. It would not come in by way of denial of a particular crime. But if you look at the actus reus, what it is there is it's what they did is he basically took doctors out knowing that they were protected. And they're not supposed to be in his thing, shared them perhaps with people who have no security clearances. That's a wrong. There's a second offense that happens, which is you could kind of conceal this and obstruct justice, which is what Donald Trump may have done in Mar-a-Lago and so forth. But the fact that he didn't commit the second offense doesn't mean that he didn't commit the first offense. And so the question is how you punish all this stuff. It's a crime. There's no question that he did it. And if he had been some ordinary Joe, somebody not named Hillary Clinton, he would have been really cashiered in a very, very heavy way. And so what it is they're saying our case is different from your case. What they couldn't say is our case is not criminal. All they could say is it's less criminal, maybe, than the other fellow's case.
It was
less criminal. I mean, the idea that both these people are running for president now The Mar-a-Lago charge is a valid charge, as best I can tell, with respect to the violation. But there, it's the kind of the equal protection notions that hit you. Hillary Clinton did a hell of a lot worse, and she did it in real time. Donald Trump waved some documents in front of other people, which were probably out of date in any event, whereas she, in real time, was being probably hacked by everybody in the United States and beyond with respect to the rickety server that she built in her own house. And they managed to let her walk. And so that's going to be what the issue is equal justice. People understand the technicalities of mens rea in criminal cases are somewhat difficult. It's perfectly clear, for example, that James Comey didn't understand them when he started to comment on that. It is not a defense to a charge that you've taken doctrine to say that you don't know what the law is. And it's incredible on its facts that the name is Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump or anybody who is in a position of power. So what we have now is kind of watching Rome fiddle as all of these weird statements become the currency of the day and the very critical issues of what do we do about the Securities Council, Securities and Exchange Commission, the FTC, the EPA, foreign affairs, the size of the military. Nobody can talk about that because we're interested in gossiping. And I think that this is a real tragedy in the United States, and this hearing is an illustration of how far things have gone. Poor Mr. Hur is a faithful public servant, as far as I can do, so I give him a round of applause.
Well, I'm impressed with her too. I don't think he's a political hack, and I don't think he's anybody's toady. I think that came across. However, that's not the same thing as agreeing with his ultimate judgment call. And based on what you just said there too, the equal protection considerations, combined with he conceded in his report that Biden's biographer destroyed evidence. And he said, well, he destroyed the recordings, but we had a transcript. Well, as the exchange between him and Gates went, well, he only destroyed some evidence. So is that if you only destroy some evidence, it's not the same obstruction crime if you right. destroy all the evidence. So he probably should have recommended charges against the biographer. And then two, he probably should have recommended charges against the big guy is the judgment call, particularly as you add that equal protection context that includes both Hillary and Trump, don't you think?
Yeah, I think it's certainly plausible that it could have done that. The problem that he had, he said, is he thought that this guy was such a doddering fool that he would never be able to get a conviction against him. And so if you actually look at the charge that is given to him, it's not to decide whether or not there's just guilt or innocence. And what you said is pretty correct. He was guilty of serious offense, as was everybody who was working with him with classified information when they didn't have a clearance. But the question of whether or not you could get a conviction is part of the recommendation required to do so. So that's why you got into the second half. I don't think he said he wasn't guilty. He said, I can't get a conviction,
right.
which is
That's
not
right.
quite the same thing. So, right. I mean, look, it's a very hard call. And remember this, the buck stops not with him. It stops with Merrill Garland. And the question is, would Garland say, I think this is sufficiently for them to prosecute? Well, that's a joke because you get Mr. Weiss back again and you can have a slow road to nothing. I mm-hmm. think what he should do is get Jack Smith properly appointed and then him bring against Biden. I don't know what I would do if I were a prosecutor. But the single most uncharted waters in criminal law is nobody's figured out how to have a rule of law campaign, which allows you in a sensible fashion to cabinet in prosecutorial discretion. It is the ongoing nightmare. And the basic answer is if you don't have good people, you're going to get bad outcomes. Nobody's been able to figure out a management team that stops rogue people, particularly at the top. Prosecutorial discretion, you got Alvin Bragg, right, as a role model. Letitia Gaines is a role model. Did they do anything that's illegal as opposed to something that's just downright stupid? Well, you're not going to be able to get them removed from office on the ground that they brought these prosecutions. So it's an open wound. And I think Herb was just trying to be honest. And it's a report. It was a confidential report, quote unquote. And if Garland says, you know what, I don't think the excuses really hold. I think my president is not senile, not doddering, not foolish. I'm going to prosecute him. Well, I'm not even sure you can do that. I mean, there's a big debate on both cases, on both sides, as to whether or not you have a sitting president. He can be prosecuted for some particular kind of crime, either in or out of office, if you haven't gone through an impeachment trial first. I mean, it's actually a very, very hard case.
Well, that's the immunity claim that Trump has made that's now in the hands of the Supreme Court. And what's your assessment of where the high court comes down on that?
Well, I think it's, I don't think they're going to accept this, because what's happened is everybody below has gone the other way on this. It's a closer case than they allowed. So my guess is that what will happen is the generalized immunity will not apply, particularly he wasn't present for all the acts that he was charged with. He was certainly present on January 6th for the last 14 days. My guess is there may be a dissent by Justice Thomas, but I would guess the majority of the court would uphold it. The thing that's very much in evidence, however, is nobody's taken seriously the double jeopardy charge. If you recall, at the impeachment trial, which was a criminal trial, they basically tried the insurrection card and they lost. You read the Jack Smith indictment of Trump, and it's Mickey Mouse stuff that they're talking about. All of the edges, defrauding somebody and so forth, and obstruction. These are minor charges, and they're also included in the insurrection charge. Because you have to do something in order to commit insurrection. And if you don't block anything and you don't defraud anybody, and all you do is watch television, that's not an insurrection. So I think, in fact, this is precluded. It's precluded for a second case. Judge Chutkan didn't give it the time of mind, but I thought she was just plain wrong on that particular issue. And what's happened is nobody seems to take it seriously, including the Wall Street Journal, which dismissed this as a one-off sentence. But double jeopardy essentially applies to any second prosecution related to an offense committed by somebody in the same branch of government. So double jeopardy applies. If the military brings an axe in somebody, you can't have a single court. If an impeachment does it, it's exactly the same way. Double jeopardy does not protect you against a state prosecution under the law. So then the question is, what's an offense? And if you allow people to give different counts of prosecutorial ever, so I'm going to prosecute for this or for this or for this coming out of the same nucleus of event, you can have an infinite number of prosecutions, which is why the correct rule is an offense covers all the legal charges that can be made out of a particular discernible event, i.e. the events of January 6th. So I think that's probably the defense that should win. And of course, I don't know if you're aware of it, but it's a very learned and I think quite powerful argument that Jack Smith was illegally appointed as the prosecutor because he never got the requisite Senate clearances as an officer. That's being argued right now before Judge Eileen Cannon. The two people who print the thing, Steve Calabresi and Gary Lawson, are two of the most eminent scholars in the country on that issue. And Ed Meese lends his weight to it, and he's a former prosecutor. And by the way, I knew him in his prime. He was a very serious man in terms of the way in which he thought about constitutional orders. He wanted to run seminars all the time. I think, in fact, that Smith should be dust in this particular case, and we'll see what she says.
Interesting. Professor Richard Epstein, James Parker Hall, Distinguished Service Professor, Emeritus of Law, Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Professor Epstein, thank you as always.
Okay, my pleasure. Bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to the podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM 560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
We heard about Joe Biden, the capitalist, again last week in the State of the Union address. He's a capitalist.
Yeah, because he says he is.
Yeah, and because he's a proponent of industrial policy. Nothing says capitalism like central planning. Okay. So the CHIPS Act, that's much touted, including by some of the Republicans who voted for it. The CHIPS Act, you know, this is good to make us less dependent on Taiwan and particularly with the looming threat of China when it comes to the chips, right? And the COVID, the chips that we need for all that we have in the modern economy. During COVID, we had the supply chain disruptions and we couldn't get the chips. And so cars couldn't get produced and rolled off to dealerships and so on. And in everything, right? Everything is,
right?
Everything is microchips. Right. It's all microchips and ball bearings these days. Anyway,
I love ball bearings.
$280 billion to subsidize semiconductor chip manufacturing in the United States and boost competitiveness with China. I don't like industrial policy, but you can see the siren song here. We've got to be chip independent, if you will. We can't rely on Taiwan semiconductor. Okay. Well, you got to read the fine print, turns out, in legislation. And I'm sure some of the Republicans who voted for it didn't or didn't care because they're just worried about the press release. I voted to fund chip manufacturer in the United States, and we're going to bring jobs to Ohio and Texas, and it's going to be great. Well, something happened along the way. The real capitalists, although on again, off again, rent seekers, the people who run those microchip manufacturers, mm-hmm. Well, they can't comply with the terms of the subsidies, all the DIE terms, diversity, equity, or diversity, inclusion, equity. And don't forget A, acceptance. So listen to this.
What have they got going?
The Biden administration promised they'd be handing out $39 billion in grants to encourage the semiconductor manufacturing in the United States. However, Intel has announced they will be holding off on their Columbus, Ohio factory, while Samsung is delaying their facility in Texas. Two experts in the private equity space had this op-ed in, over at The Hill, two guys with Strive Asset Management, believe the company's decisions to back out of building manufacturing facilities in the U.S. stems from the DIE requirements. The subsidies are so loaded with DEI that it can't move, said one of these op-ed writers from Strive Asset Management. So instead, Intel is now building manufacturing plants in Poland and Israel. They'd rather deal with the prospect of Russian aggression or rockets from Hamas than DIE mandates in the United States. Samsung is pivoting towards making their chips, standing up a new facility in South Korea. A Taiwan semiconductor manufacturing company has also pushed back production of a second facility they were going to build in Arizona. The glorious capitalists and slash central planners slash race hustlers. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined, as always, by Steve Moore, economist, GovZilla author. Steve, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Hey, good morning, guys. And by the way, I'm raising my hand. I'm a capitalist. But by the way, I want to raise taxes by $5 trillion. I'm introducing a $7.5 trillion budget. And we're going to, you know, the government's going to be half of the economy. But I'm a capitalist. I'm a free market guy. You know, that example that you just cited about the ridiculous, preposterous hundreds of billions of dollars of subsidies to the chip manufacturers. We should have learned by now that if you really want to destroy an industry, have the government subsidize it. I mean, Amy, look what's happened with the electric vehicle industry. You know, this is, oh, we're going to have an electric vehicle in every garage in America. And it turns out, you know, that because of all these subsidies and trying to force feed people to buy these things, you know, the electric vehicle industry is on the verge of bankruptcy. Same thing with what has happened over the last 30 years with solar energy and wind energy. They're nowhere. They account for, you know, a tiny fraction of our energy, despite the fact that we keep throwing money at them. And now you're seeing the same thing with the chips manufacturers. They can't comply with all the regulations. And it's amazing, despite the government's dangling all these billions of dollars in front of them, they say, no, thank you. We can't do it because, you know what? We don't have enough LGBTQ people on our payroll. We don't have enough women on our payroll. We don't have enough Hispanics, this group, that group. We don't have enough short people on our, you know, this is craziness. And most of that, the only good news about this story, Dan, is maybe the government's not going to be able to spend all that money because nobody wants it.
Oh, yeah. The only bad news to that good news is that they'll find somewhere else to waste it. It's not like they're giving it back. Yeah.
Right. Actually, you know what? That's an interesting point because I just wrote a column on something called empowerment power, which is a power that Trump is saying, give me empowerment power if I'm elected. And empowerment used to be that if a president if the Congress had authorized money for a project, but the president deemed that, you know, well, you don't need all that money to do it, he could just not spend the money. And here's an example of, okay, you know what? They don't need the $300 billion. So I've got an idea. Why don't we just save the money and not spend it? But the president doesn't have the authority to do it. I mean, it's craziness. What kind of a CEO of a company that's losing, you know, billions of dollars a year, you know, spends every penny they can get a hold of?
I wanted to get your reaction to Trump, the comments he made on CNBC with Joe Kernan and Aaron Ross Sorkin the other day, that to have, you know, the the pundits inside the Beltway say, oh, it's an unforced error on the conversation he had, the statement he made about entitlements. Let's hear, listen to what he said, and then I want you to translate what his view actually is on entitlements, since you know him. Let's take a listen.
We've got a $33, $34 trillion total debt built up, and very little we can do in terms of cutting spending. Discretionary is not going to help. Have you changed your outlook on how to handle entitlements, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, Mr. President? It seems like something has to be done, or else we're going to be stuck at 120% of debt to GDP forever.
So first of all, there is a lot you can do in terms of entitlements, in terms of cutting, and in terms of also the theft and the bad management of entitlements, tremendous bad management of entitlements. There's tremendous amounts of things and numbers of things you can do. So I don't, you know, necessarily agree with the statement.
So, I mean, it's sort of like I said, I'm open to cutting entitlements, but I'm not open to cutting entitlements. So which is it?
Well, I agree with what Trump said. And I think what he meant to say, and I think he said it pretty clearly, unless you wanted to distort, you know, the media's kind of, the Democrats are distorting what he said. He said, look, there's a tremendous amount of waste and fraud in these programs. Guess what, folks? There is. I mean, if you look at Medicare and Medicaid, two of the three biggest programs in the budget, I mean, hundreds of billions of dollars are stolen from that program. Nobody in government does anything about it. They act as if it's just a cost of doing business. We know that, you know, a lot of these checks are going to people that don't even live in the United States, for goodness sakes. You know, the drug companies are ripping off these programs. The health insurance companies are ripping off these programs. The hospitals are ripping off these programs, all paid for by, you know, by taxpayers. So absolutely, yes. And by the way, I didn't hear one word. You know, here Biden's talking about hundreds of billions of dollars of new spending programs. Dan and Amy, I looked at his budget. I listened to his State of the Union. I didn't hear him talk about one penny that he wants to cut from the trillions of dollars of spending. So, yes, absolutely, you can cut hundreds of billions of dollars out of these programs, these trillion-dollar programs, and it will not affect the beneficiaries. It'll root out the fraud and waste and the inefficiency of these programs.
Rooting out the fraud, waste, and abuse of massive, centrally planned state programs. Right. I mean, talk about tilting at windmills. Right. I mean, you can change incentives and do some of that. But I mean, fundamentally, I mean, we have to be a little bit honest as conservatives to say, look, we rail against central planning, except when it comes to important industries like healthcare. What kind of sense does that make?
Well, look, the government has ruined our healthcare system. There's no question about it. We consider ourselves a capitalist free market economy. But guess what? Half of the health industry is government today.
Right.
You know, so it's half private, half government. And so it leads to all sorts of dysfunctions in the way we pay for healthcare. I mean, we should be able to cut our healthcare expenditures almost in half if we were to do it smartly without people losing, you know, treatment for cancer or heart disease or other, you know, ailments or, you know, closing hospitals. We can do this. And, you know, Trump is a businessman. He knows how to go after the waste. Now, on Social Security, my view is Social Security benefits are way too low. People have gotten totally ripped off by Social Security. Mm-hmm. I mean, Social Security is the worst investment you'll ever make in your life, folks. I mean, if you had done what Steve Forbes and I and others have been talking about 40 years ago and let every young person, and I guess Dan, Amy, and you and I, all of us, we're not as young as we used to be, but if we could have just put 12% of our paycheck into like a index fund, we wouldn't be getting, the average Social Security benefit is $1,900 a month. We'd be getting about $8,000 a month if we just put the money. So let's convert Social Security into like a 401k plan so people can get a half decent return on their money.
What's going on with like prices though? Because Biden kept saying, you know, inflation is keeps going down, right. But that is not the case. I mean, prices are going up, and same with gas. Gas is almost at $5.
You better believe it. Yeah, you're so right about that, Amy. And you know, I laugh when all these are, oh, you know, finally we're turning the corner on inflation. No, we're not. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, it is true that we had 9.1% inflation in 2022, but we're still running, you know, the latest report has us on, you know, if we keep this trend up, we're going to have 5% inflation. That's a lousy number. And it means that, you know, people just can't afford to buy things, their groceries, their gas. Look at mortgage payments, by the way. You know, the average mortgage payment today per month is $1,100 on a new home, $1,100 a month higher than it was when Trump was president because of the higher mortgage rates. And Biden says, oh, well, that's okay. I'm going to give you – did you see this, Dan? We're going to give you $5,000, a check from the government if you buy a new house. Well, guess what? My payments are, you know, $10,000 a year higher. I mean, and by the way, the reason that the mortgage payments are so much higher now is because inflation is so high, interest rates are higher, and so he wants to even spend more money, which is going to make the problem worse.
You got to spend money. You got to keep spending money to prevent from going bankrupt. That's his famous formulation, and he means it. And
no,
and
he needs
to keep spending money to buy back voters too, which is what he's trying to do.
Well, the thing is, I want to go back to what Amy was saying because, you know, you are so right. And when I go to the grocery store, people see me at the gas pump and stuff, people get so angry at me because I only recite the official numbers. But people say, what are you talking about? Look, the prices of food are up 23%. The price of gasoline is up 40%. Mortgage payments have almost doubled. And the government's telling us inflation's 4%.
Yeah, rent 19%.
Yeah,
home heating costs, it's all just a big hot mess.
Yeah.
Speaking of...
Four more years.
Speaking of the situation on the ground, you, over at your Unleash Prosperity newsletter, I see you did a little stop, look, and listen and assessment of where states are at in terms of job creation post-pandemic.
Yeah.
And we have some laggard states, Illinois being one of them.
I didn't want to depress people this morning, Dan. But, you know, Illinois is still, you know, one of the four or five. I think I forget where they were on the list. I think maybe fourth or fifth from the bottom. And guess what? This is in part because of what we've talked about, taxes and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, did you know that Friday is the four-year anniversary of COVID lockdowns?
And I'm wearing
really
a mask to celebrate.
And it's really important for people to understand. This was the greatest, at least in our lifetimes, and maybe in the history of this country, the greatest public policy calamity ever in our country's history. The evidence is now crystal clear that lockdowns did not work. They did not spread stop the spread of the virus. Everybody eventually got exposed to the virus. And what we did to our kids, what we did to our businesses. We can never allow this to happen again. And guess what? It was states like Illinois and California and New Jersey and New York that kept their economies locked down far longer than they should. I mean, you were closed down for practically a year. Chicago, you couldn't even go downtown Chicago, and it was the streets were empty. That was a tragic mistake, and God forbid that we ever do that again.
I carried around papers saying I was an essential worker. That we got from our boss here.
You are essential. Well, you, Dan, and Amy are two of the most essential workers in the Chicago.
Oh, well. Boy, okay. Put that on the website. Steve Moore, economist, GovZilla author. Thanks for the thanks as always, Steve. Appreciate it.
Okay. Dan, I'm glad you're still wearing your mask.
Me and Bernie. Yeah, me and Bernie.
Yeah.
And I'm never throwing those papers away, just to remind ourselves. All right, and Mr. Moore joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Those Canadians, they're just a half a step ahead of CPS. We'll get there. Ottawa Carleton School District has an innovative approach to their graduation ceremony, which is that you don't have to graduate in order to graduate.
Okay.
Right? You don't have to graduate to graduate. Let them explain.
Katie Griffin is here with details on this. Katie?
Well, Graham, the school board says changing graduation to commencement would make things more inclusive, so much so that those who aren't graduating can still participate.
It's a milestone students worked towards for years.
So if you don't pass, why would you get to go to graduation?
The Ottawa-Carleton District School Board is updating its graduation policy, renaming it commencement to include all students, even those who are not getting diplomas.
They haven't graduated, essentially. So walking across the stage is something that you work towards. There might be another way I'm sure they can come up with including them. But not walking across the stage.
The proposed policy acknowledges some students may not be graduating for a variety of reasons, but that it should not preclude them from celebrating their achievements.
The way I look at it, any student who has gone through high school has worked very hard. There are going to be students with special education needs who are never going to be able to qualify for an OSSD, who have worked very hard by the end of their time in high school. And to allow recognition to those students of all of their hard work makes a lot of sense to me.
The board is also looking at phasing out awards, renaming them achievements.
312-642-5600, turkey.pro, answer line 646-36-DA, turkey.pro, text line. Everyone gets an achievement and a diploma.
What about valedictorian or?
Ooh, that sounds very meritocratic, very patriarchal,
athletic
very
award.
Very white supremacy. Yeah, yeah.
Choir award.
Yeah, I mean, it's like the stand-up comedian Fred Stoller used to do this bit where he's like, you know, he didn't finish college. He said, but, you know, my friends are always telling me, Fred, you're like, you know, you should finish college. And he said, well, why? Because then you could say I'm a college graduate. And he said, what, I can't say it now? I'm a college graduate. Yeah, I can say it. I go, oh, 2 credits short. No, I can say it now. So what's the difference? It's what we do in CPS. I mean, CPS is already there. They just haven't formalized it the way that Ottawa-Carleton has, right? I mean, and frankly, all the school districts, because what do you mean it's not?
No.
What do you mean it's not?
They have been, if there's a child in the district who is truant, but they still want to participate in the graduation ceremony, they can go. If they still want to go to prom, they can go. If they still want to go to a home football game, they can go. The school has to let them into the event.
Well, of course, there's no difference between a graduate and a non-graduate, other than some people making these weird references to working for something or having to clear some sort of academic threshold, the implication there. I mean, you know, it's no difference between citizens and non-citizens, graduates and non-graduates. It's just so we've gone through this documentation with Ted Dabrowski over at WirePoints, which is a third of the kids, let's say, in a class in a particular school read at grade level, third of, you know, 12th graders reading at grade level, a quarter doing math at grade level, which is probably on the high side in CPS, most of the schools. And the graduation rate is 91%. What's the difference? You can't read or do math. You're going to get a diploma. And somebody else who just didn't go through those same classes where they didn't learn to read or do math doesn't have a diploma. Call them both graduates. Who cares? What's the material difference between the two? And it's the same in the suburban school districts, too. It's just the numbers are a little bit closer in terms of the population that is not ready for the workforce or post-secondary schooling coming out of high school. But they're a high school graduate. What, I can't say it because I can't read or do math? I'm a high school graduate.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. You can also reach us on our text line, 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
Dawn in Naperville, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
He never said they were going to graduate with a diploma. He never said that. And for those who don't understand, if you don't have a high school diploma, you're not going to be able to get a job. You won't be able to go to college, any college. How is that accessible? There's a huge difference. As a matter of fact, the most recent Perez case that went to the Supreme Court, the school told the parents the kid was going to graduate with a high school diploma. Guess what? Never did. So now the parents are taking the case to the Supreme Court because the kid did not graduate with a diploma. So parents have got to pay attention. Make sure that your kid is graduating or going to be graduating with all of the credits. That is what you call equal access. They're absolutely awful. There is a huge difference. He's talking about a certificate, which is garbage. It doesn't mean
So's the diploma in most places. That's the point. Yeah, I mean, I get the technical paperwork issue, and I know they're defending this on this grounds that, well, it's to be inclusive to kids with learning disabilities, stuff like that. But that's just a smokescreen. And frankly, so is this. I mean, why wouldn't they give them diplomas at some point? Why won't they just give them diplomas? They're giving people diplomas who've also not done the coursework. They may have been in class, but they haven't been able to master the coursework. So that's where this is all going. Think one step ahead here. Yeah, thanks for the call, Dawn. But you didn't get all your credits. I can't read and do math, and you're worried about where I'm going to college? You're worried about what trade I'm going to go into or job I'm going to get other than as, I don't know, you know, some clerk job, even that. I'm not responsible enough to do my coursework, to learn the basics. I don't have the adult supervision / pressure, whatever the circumstances is. The whole idea that anything coming out of these systems is legitimate, that's the joke. And yeah, you know, they're going to be people regardless of how DEI-addled and substandard the education is. They're going to go out, these are smart people, and your parents, kids that have, you know, the kind of support / direction at home, they're going to go out and they're going to be engineers and they're going to be biologists. They're going to do great things. They're going to be smart. But they're also going to be part of the managerial class that ends America. And this is what you should be concerned about rather than phony credentials. The diploma, in most cases, maybe a slight overstatement, in a lot of schools, in most cases, is as phony as some certificate they cook up for the kid who's 2 credits short. What is the substantive capacity of the students that you're producing? That should be the question. Not what's the credential you're conferring. The achievement you're renaming into an achievement rather than an award or an honor, the valedictorian, salutatorian titles and so forth, distinctions. So the talented people, because these incubators of totalitarianism are amoral, character-free. Everybody spends all their time in spinning the wheel of power and privilege. And then you've got some students that are that have particular aptitudes and work hard and have direction, and they're going to survive and thrive in any environment. And that's going to be great for them because they're going to be successful in our materialist society's eyes. And because they are characterless and godless, they're going to be the implementers of the subjugation of the masses. That's how it works. I mean, that's how it always works in totalitarian societies. You don't think there's talented and smart people in China or Russia? Of course there are. They're the ones pulling the levers, managing the lives, subjugating is a more accurate term, of those who didn't have the same aptitudes, talents, support networks, opportunities, paths to political power. I mean, the world that we're creating now, don't even bother sending your kid to school. Send him to the Democrat Party and have him start walking precincts and making connections and doing favors, because that's the path to power and success in this country, the way that this is going. And we're worried about credentials, and we stand up these phony institutions and pretend they're legitimate. Frank and Palatine.
Good morning, guys. Great topic. Always terrific listening to you guys in the morning. I've seen this, and it drives me nuts. my good friend Jack Rosier, who used to run championnews.org, he used to hire people to work for him in his factory, but he gave them a test. And if they could pass a sixth grade math and reading test, he would hire them. Sixth grade. They had a high school diploma. He wouldn't hire them unless they could pass a sixth grade. He'd probably have to give them a kindergarten test now if Jack was still alive. Ridiculous. But his numbers worked. Numbers work. Bullshit doesn't.
Bull jive. It's funny you mentioned that because I know Jack Rosier, Auto Engineering, which is a great company. Yeah, that's a manufacturer of parts for the aerospace industry. And he's taking high school graduates and saying, I'll put you into the ground floor if you can pass a sixth grade math test. You're making parts for the aerospace industry. But it's all just snuck up on us. And we're all just going to continue pantomiming that everything's fine and we just need to get our papers in order and our credentials squirreled away and everything's going to be fine. Manny, Southside.
You know, Dan, you're forgetting to mention that the actual losers on this will be the student that wants to learn.
What
force
is
the teacher to teach on this?
100%. Absolutely. The whole system is, Manny, if I've said this once, I've said it a million times in the last 15 years. The Chicago public school system is a criminal enterprise. It is a conspiracy to defraud children of the opportunity to earn a quality education. And I know there are good teachers and good administrators and exceptions and blah, blah, blah. Whatever. I got it. I got the exceptions. I'm making a blanket statement. There are always exceptions. There are always green shoots. There are always people that survive in any environment, thrive in any environment, and will. Got it. But the system as a whole, what is it? Speaking of the numbers, the numbers are so overwhelming, you'd have to be Cam Buckner. You'd have to lie with the facility of Cam Buckner in order to believe anything other than what I've described. They're overwhelming. And everybody sees it, but they don't see it. Because as much as we pile on the Chicago Public School System, the same thing is happening to a lesser degree in these bull jive suburban government school systems and a lot of the private schools too, especially the Catholic ones that have given over to the secular humanism of the state schools at the feet of Supich and Bishop Hicks and Joliet and these other quislings of the cloth, if you will. But the same thing's happening. And suburban families turn a blind eye. So I'm not singling out, families in the Chicago public school system. The suburban families are doing it, too. Now, these are still great schools. Oh, the Glenbard this and the Naperville that and the Downers this. Totally delusional. Completely delusional. Not even close. And go ahead and pile on the stories of Johnny Smith and Sally Q, who went on to do these great things. Of course. Of course. And then think about the numbers. Think about the success stories. Think about what people are doing. And think about the mass of numbers rolling through these school districts every 8 years, school systems, every 8 years and 4 years and overall 12 years. And you tell me that America is winning and most of these kids are winning and they are being shepherded on a path to greatness. Go ahead and try to make that case. I'd love to hear somebody try and make it. John in Villa Park.
Hey, Dan. Yeah, excellent challenge to their stupid stance. But just to make a little light, don't forget, they're all saying they worked hard. Well, Barbara Boxer worked hard. She doesn't want to be called ma'am, right? That was good.
Yeah, classic Zucker brothers. Yeah. Please call me Senator. I've worked very hard for that title. Karen and Beecher.
Oh, good morning. To me, it's kind of like the same old, same old. Everybody is just going to be given a participation ribbon or trophy. Thank you very much for participating and playing.
hate those things.
Thanks, Karen.
Deborah. Got a great text message.
Okay, go ahead.
Can't wait for the engineering certificate as opposed to the engineering degree.
Yeah.
Because you really want to mess around in that department.
Yeah.
Doctors,
Does anybody know who's got the engineering certificate around here? We got a problem with the landing gear on our 747. Anybody with an engineering certificate? Deborah in Arlington Heights.
Good morning. I this is going back a little ways, but I was a kid in the city and I went to Catholic school. And when we moved to the suburbs, my parents switched me to public school. And like we had already learned at least a year before the things that I was learning in the public school. And I couldn't believe how much, even as a kid, easier it was. And then with my own kids going to public school in the suburbs, over time, I saw how the standards would be lowered and I would push back on some stuff. And I'm like, you're not teaching them this. You're not teaching them that. Like, this isn't important. I just couldn't believe, like, some of the changes that were being made, not for the better.
Right. Thanks for the call. Well, I mean, there's been this attack on meritocracy that is the last several generations. You don't think it has an impact?
Got another
You think it's like it's happening? And all these things, I have a feeling that people, if they're not having been like personally impacted and they've got it all to get together enough where everything's going pretty well for them and their kids and all that, which is great. But you think like this, the stuff that we talk about is happening in some distant land, like this attack on meritocracy isn't happening in a way that it materially impacts you. And that's just not true. It is, I mean, however you want to describe it, the dumbing down, the lowering of standards, the attack on meritocracy, the attack on actual achievement, the end of the culture of challenging people as opposed to coddling them and accommodating them and making excuses for them. You don't think that has, like, an exponential impact on culture and the quality of the institutions and what they're producing?
Text message, Dan and Amy, I'm a garbage man. I was a D student. Most of the guys I work with didn't graduate college. We're all making over $120,000 a year. Our management needs a bachelor's degree, and they make $65,000 and no more.
Yeah, I get it, and that's great. And, I mean, that's fine. That's an honorable job. I mean, any job where you're providing a service and abiding the law and paying your bills is honorable. That's fine. But I mean, but it's not to be measured always in what your take home pay is. It's so much bigger than that. I don't know how to describe in another way the impact of the institutional rot. Maybe at the end of the day, because actually that's what we've seen over the last few years, is that the people that have the least time in these institutions are going to be the ones most positioned to salvage us because they have the better instincts and they got a little courage, too. I think of the freedom truckers in Canada and the yellow vests in France. I mean, who is going to take up the fight? I don't know if it'll be by professional sector, but maybe by orientation. The people with the least amount of times in these institutions will be the ones that are willing to fight for the freedom that are enshrined in our founding documents. Because the institutionalists have zero fight. They don't even see the disintegration happening. They're cheering it on. So, I guess it's going to be, garbage men and over-the-road truck drivers are bust for us. Roger, Southside.
Hi, Dan, Amy, morning. I agree just what you said on that, Dan. I think I don't know if you want to call it right or left, our fighting force for the all the stuff we talk about, you guys talk about every single day, every issue that goes down. Yeah, I think our fighting force is an old fighting force. You know, it's a 40 and up, okay? But it is with experience, and it does have teeth. where it goes from there. No, I think all of these kids, they've got it from day one, whether it be social media or education program. You know, I mean, public schools, the indoctrination. So it's a battle just to pull kids away from that. I mean, you can't even get teenagers to, you can't guilt them into taking their own garbage out. You know what I'm saying?
Thanks for the call, Roger. But I think it's different in different households. I mean, I think I really do. I think it has a lot to do with just sort of your faith and your sort of philosophical outlook on life, which would be informed by your faith. So, I mean, I should add that piece of it in terms of the troops, if you will, and I don't mean this in a revolutionary way, but maybe. That will fight for the God-given rights that are enshrined in our founding documents. Because, of course, the armed services of a lot of people with college degrees and so forth. But I'm just flabbergasted by the pull that phony credentials have. They've just bought off so much. These institutions have bought off so much of the public through phony credentials that just get you on a phony track to live one of their cookie cutter lives in the system where you are to, you know, clap when you're told to clap. And shut up when you're told to shut up. And that's what you do. And that's what you want your kids to do, which is even more baffling to me. I guess there's just a lot of people that, you know, are fish that don't realize they're in water. They're sort of in that state.
This is The Morning Show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Do you think the new Marxists in America are much different than they are in Canada or Belgium?
No, they're all the same.
If you don't, if you think they're all the same, then you may want to perk your ears up.
Uh-oh, I'm wrong again?
No, I don't think you're wrong. I think that because they don't have the same restraints on government that we do, they're maybe a little bit ahead of us in terms of their autocratic measures. Although, you know, as we were talking about earlier, on the flip side, very interesting to see Britain decide to stop providing puberty blockers to kids under the age of 18. That's something we can't get many states in this country to do, certainly not the President of the United States to do.
Oh, heavens no.
Congress with Senate control in the hands of the new Marxists. On February 26th, Justin Trudeau, he is that grade school drama teacher that the Canadians made their prime minister.
He's single now, you know.
I'm sorry to hear that. Yeah. He's introduced Bill C-63. The Online Harms Act, which targets hate speech on the Internet. Okay. One of its provisions would enable anyone with the consent of the federal attorney general to, quote, lay an information before a provincial court judge if the person fears on reasonable grounds that another person will commit a hate speech offense. The judge then issues a peace bond imposing conditions, including house arrest or electronic monitoring, on the defendant because of the fear he could post a hate message online. It's pre-crime. It's Minority Report.
Yep.
Hollywood foreshadowing strikes again. It also would allow for life sentences for certain speech crimes.
Life sentence? Come on.
I'm not kidding. For example,
death threats. I mean, what are you talking?
Well, you would think the commission of a murder, not a threat, would be the thing that would be subject to a life sentence. But the legislation would put people in prison for life for things like advocating genocide, quote unquote. Would increase the maximum penalty specifically for advocating genocide from 5 years to life in prison. And from 2 years to 5 years on in it, for an indictment for willful promotion of hatred. And you say, well, people shouldn't be advocating for genocide. Well, right. Yeah, obviously. A couple things. First, what constitutes advocating genocide? And who is or isn't? Because you may have noticed that, for example, the Palestinians and the pro-Hamas supporters on college campuses are running around saying Israel is a genocidal state, and they're attempting to eradicate the Palestinians and all sorts of things. On the other side, you could say, well, wait a second, when the Palestinians say from the river to the sea or recite the particulars of Hamas's charter, they're advocating for the genocide. So everybody goes to prison for life or 5 years to life? How do you start to define that? Oh, well, we'll tell you how we'll define that. We'll define that. That's how we'll tell you. You'll know when we tell you based on who we imprison for things that they said. In Belgium, just to put a fine point on it, a far-right activist has been put in jail for a year for what authorities deemed racist speeches. I don't know who this guy is. The judge called what he promoted, what he said, as like hateful Nazi negationist propaganda. And that may be true. But I mean, you really want to get into the business of prison sentences when people say things that are intemperate, ignorant, simply you disagree with? That's where you want to go? Well, that's where Canada wants to go, and Belgium. And I think, as you said, Amy, every other group, sort of ruling group of the new Marxist movement in the West, that's what it seems to me, because we're seeing a lot of this. And it incubates from the K-12 systems where this is the norm, not imprisonment, but punishment, ostracization. Worse. For more on this, Conrad Black joins us, Lord Black, Baron Black of Cross Harbor. So cool. Businessman, writer, former newspaper publisher, author of the new book, The Political and Strategic History of the World, Volume 1, From Antiquity to the Caesars, 14 AD. Conrad Black, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Glad to be back with you, Dan and Amy.
Well, as a writer and somebody in the newspaper publishing business once upon a time, what do you make of the commitment to free and open expression and discussion and debate and reporting in the West these days?
There are causes for concern, as you say. I would like to reply, if I may, on the Canadian picture particularly to some of the things you said.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, the Trudeau government is on the way out. All the polls show that it will lose the next election, which is next year. Secondly, the bill that you described is subject to parliamentary modification. Third, as written, I believe the courts will shred it. I mean, everything that you said is antithetical to the precedent of 150 years in this country. And you're quite right. The powers are far too arbitrary, and the penalties appear to be far too severe. Next, I would say that it is only possible to entertain such a thing in a country that is profoundly tolerant. There is very, very little racial friction in Canada. And because, not because we're so virtuous, but there was never any economic justification for slavery. You know, I mean, the idea was that Africans were better at bringing in tropical crops like cotton and tobacco than white people, but we don't have cotton and tobacco in this country. And so no one is here who didn't wish to come here or his ancestors wished to come here. So we don't have a lot of racial problems, so we're not talking about as serious an issue as it might be in a country with a more complicated sociology. But everything that you said is far from written in stone. The criticisms implicit in what you recited have been uttered here very loudly and very widely, and there is great concern about it. And the final thing I'd say is it's the courts that are involved here, and we do have a judicial system of great integrity. Unlike you, we do not have a 98% conviction rate, as you do in federal crimes. The defense speaks last and not the prosecution, and the plea bargain system doesn't exist here. If in this country, as is very frequent practice in the United States, prosecutors interviewed potential witnesses and said, as they do in the U.S., you'd better find some evidence against Mr. Propt here, or we're assuming there's a conspiracy to subvert justice, and you're part of it, and we'll accuse you. But if you do cure yourself of this amnesia, we'll give you a guarantee of no charge of perjury. Any prosecutor who tried that in this country would be disbarred. So it isn't as bad as it looks. But the bill is, you're quite right, an outrage. But I predict to you and your listeners, it will not pass in its present form. And if it does, the courts will overturn it.
Well, that's fine. And there's daffy ideas that come up all the time. But then you see them as sort of reflective of a larger culture.
It's dangerous. Yeah. And we've all got to be on guard against going too far. None of us like hate speech, but the answer to hate speech isn't arbitrary prison sentences of outrageous length.
And who even decides who's offended by what?
Well, I think
you've got to measure the right of freedom of expression against the undesirability of stirring up hatred on a racial basis or any basis, really.
Well, yeah.
That's a challenge for legislators. It's been there for a long time, and we have to do a better job of it. But certainly the bill you mentioned as written is rubbish, and that opinion is very widely held in this country.
Yeah, I'm encouraged by that. I hope that's true. But then there's also sort of the consequences. You talk about the court system. So the High Court in Canada ruled that the Trudeau government extended overreach. They did things that were beyond their power to do with the Freedom Convoy truckers when it came to freezing bank accounts and so forth. So what is the what is the recompense for those who were wronged by the government in that case?
Well, I think the government is now very liable to lawsuits. I mean, Supreme Court, the court judgment in that case stated that the Prime Minister did not have the constitutional right in the circumstances that prevailed to invoke what's called the Emergencies Act. And anyone who was wronged by that mistaken decision on his part has a right of action against the federal government. It's not a toothless tiger here. I mean, obviously, in the end, the taxpayers will pay for Justin Trudeau's error, but the victims will be compensated.
Yeah. Thinking about this, it's interesting, sort of the comparative political and judicial systems between America and the U.S., America and Canada. But it's just sort of the larger cultural zeitgeist. And it is not in the direction of, Louis Brandeis and the cure for speech you don't like is more speech. That, I guess, is my larger point. And the other side, and we see it in Ireland, too, where they've wanted to criminalize misgendering people and so forth. So that just seems to be where it's going. And the other side is feeling their oats, it seems to me. They're completely unafraid. And the side that believes in free minds and free markets and a free society is a little tentative, a little too tentative for me.
I agree with you. On the other hand, I have to tell you that if the heads of the leading universities in this country, say McGill University in Montreal and the University of Toronto and, say, the big French university, Laval, I'm an alumnus of Laval and McGill. If the heads of those universities told a parliamentary committee that the advocacy of the what amounted to the extermination of the Jews was a matter whose appropriateness was subject to context, they'd be out the next day, or mm-hmm. probably the same day if it was before 3 o'clock that they said it. We're all wrestling with the same problems. You mm-hmm. people have a more complicated sociology. You do have a revolutionary tradition where things are constitutionally explicitly stated, and we're going off a general framework of laws and at a very long period of precedence, but they add up to almost the same thing. I mean, you will not get an abolition of free speech in Canada. I give you my word, it will not happen.
All right. Conrad Black, Lord Black, Baron Black of Cross Harbor, businessman, writer, former newspaper publisher, author of the new book, The Political and Strategic History of the World, Volume 1, From Antiquity to the Caesars in 14 AD. Baron Black, Conrad Black, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate
Conrad
it.
Conrad will do it.
I appreciate it. My
title and the correct fare get me Chicago public transit system.
I just like saying Baron. I feel like I'm in an episode of Game of Thrones when I say Baron Black. I don't know.
It's good for getting a dinner reservation in London.
Oh, yeah.
Thanks, Conrad Black. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Dan and Amy. Bye.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey. Pro answer line.
This is the morning show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's morning answer on AM 560. The answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.